Hey, so I'm Amy. I'm the host of the Woman in Comedy podcast, and I get to chat with amazing women in the industry, behind the scenes, up on the stage, all about their journey, and a little bit about me. So I work as a programmer for the Woman in Comedy Festival here in Manchester. I also work as a progression booker and look after Beat the Frog for the Frog and Bucket, and work as an artist liaison. Is pretty much me, and I've worked in comedy since 2013. And I started this podcast because I just wanted to talk to amazing women, really, and just have a platform for us to chat and just be ourselves and talk about what it is to be in this amazing, magical, sometimes hard industry. So sit back, grab a brew and a Becky, and enjoy the podcast. Today I'm chatting with Tati McLeod. When she came and visited us last year during Christmas, well, just before Christmas, at the Frog and Bucket. So sit back and enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, that's weird that we worked.
Yeah.
But then again, I guess that's the kind of vibe about Angel Comedy Club, isn't it? It's just like you're kind of, everyone has been through those doors.
Yeah.
And that was when I first started getting into like stand-up, was when I worked there.
Were you doing that? Because I started in October 2018.
That must have been just when I were, okay, this is, right, let me make sense of my timeline here. Maybe I started that. That can't be possible because we would definitely
No, we would have known. Yeah. But I was only working like two nights a week. I worked a Friday and a, I think that's my phone. Sorry.
So maybe I was doing the nights that you weren't doing.
Maybe
we had the same job and I was doing the nights that you weren't doing.
Yeah, because I was there just on the weekends. And then I ended up running Sundays. And then Barry needed some time off. Sarah was pregnant.
I was there before then. I was there. Then I must have left before then because I found out Sarah was pregnant when it came up on Facebook, but I wasn't there.
So when I started, she was just about to go on to maternity leave. And then Masood and I had a weird connection.
I did not know where you were going to go with that.
No.
I was like, Masood and I had an
affair. No, Masood and I, years and years and years ago, I am still to this day extremely close friends with his half-sister, Rashida.
Unrelated to comedy.
And we found that out, but like just by, because we knew he had worked in New Zealand and he knew where I worked at the Classic Comedy Club and he had left just before I started, similar storyline. And then he was like, do you know my half-sister Rashida? I was like, oh my God, she's one of my oldest friends. And he was like,
that's wild.
I'm her brother. And I was like, what?
It's really mind-boggling when those moments come up. I'm trying to think of ones that I've had with people. Yeah, I mean, not so much in the comedy. I'm trying to think of any comedian with whom I've had those moments of being like, oh my God, you know so-and-so from... But it definitely does happen. And then it's creepy. That's really impressive, though, because we're talking spanning continents.
Yeah.
And Masood is not a New Zealander.
No.
So it's not... There's no kind of reason why... It's,
I know.
Make more sense if... Because where is Masood from?
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong. Right. It makes more sense if you had like... I lived in Hong Kong and then...
Yeah.
fact that you know from New Zealand...
Yeah.
His sister, who... Yeah.
Anyway. I know. But that's how small New Zealand is. When people are like, do you... You know, New Zealand's so small. Do you know everyone? You're like, no, we do not. Yeah. And then they say a name and you're like, yeah, I do know them.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't insult me. It's like that with Iceland, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, similar sort of thing. Small countries.
Yeah, we are little babies. Yeah, really, baby. Have you had a good weekend?
Had a great weekend, actually. It's been really nice. It's my first time doing a club gig. And I call this a club gig.
Yeah.
So, a Thursday night, I did Signature Brew in London. So, similar in terms of numbers of people.
Mm.
That was like a 250-seater as well. But not set up as a club and not like a weekend.
Yeah.
And so just a different kind of atmosphere. And so when I talk about club, I mean like Frog and Bucket, the Glees, the Stands, Comedy Store. I haven't done a club in like a while.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because you've been doing your show, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been doing my show, Edinburgh. Pre-Edinburgh, I was in like full previews. Mm. Post-Edinburgh, I was away for like practically 2 months. I only came back to the UK in like November.
Yeah.
And I was gigging a bit out in France and I was doing a lot of writing work. So like working the whole time, but you know, with comedy, it's like there are so many different aspects to it that aren't just doing sets and doing clubs. So yeah, I haven't done a club in a bit.
Yeah. And this one is especially because it's like pre-Christmas.
Yeah.
So they're a little bit more spicy. They're a little bit more like, hey.
Yeah. I mean, you always kind of expect that when you go into a club, I think.
Yeah.
But I definitely have seen that different clubs seem to, like, I think the Glee Club in Birmingham, because of the way the tables are designed, actually you don't get as much rowdiness in my experience because no table is facing inwards.
Yeah.
So you're never going to have a group of people who are looking at each other from across the table because it's like an amphitheater.
You're sat
facing and no one's in front of you, which I think helps. For like having no kind of like no one being encouraged to have chatter, whereas like Brighton Comedia, everyone sat opposite each other, and that's one which can lead to like audiences. The moment they're a little bit bored, just be like, "Oh yeah, mate, how has your weekend been?"
Yeah,
and just get into that kind of conversation.
Yeah, ours used to be like that, Viking style, but then we changed it to this way, and it's been a lot better.
Really?
But yeah.
I can imagine, but yeah, as you say, a little bit spicy. But up for it as well.
Yeah.
You know, like a nice audience which you have to like be confident with, but an audience who are into it and present and want to laugh.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely had them in the palm of your hands. As I said to you earlier, I said this to her earlier. I was like, you've got them in the palm of your hands.
That's funny.
Yeah. It was great because some people don't, you know, like Christmas crowds are a different ball game.
I can definitely rise to the, because I think I'm quite confident on stage. Mm. Like I am confident on stage, but also there's confidence on stage and there's also status. And I think I probably am high status. Not probably am. It's always a hard thing because it's like, how are you looking outside upon yourself?
Mm.
And I guess I'm framing it more in the sense of this is what I have been told. And I think it probably resonates with me. I don't have a part of my act, which is self deprecating.
Mm.
So I think that enables me to have quite a big stage presence and to be able to go in and to really emote a confidence, which I think in these kind of rooms sometimes maybe you definitely need to be confident full stop, but I think also kind of having an energy of like, don't fuck with me can be quite helpful, even if it feels at times like it's quite artificially put on.
Yeah.
Like you just know when you're coming into these kinds of gigs that you have to be. I mean, yesterday, I think one of the problems was is that when I got up on stage, I picked up the mic.
Oh, yeah.
And the cable came out.
Yeah.
Like just fluke. Like I picked it up in such a place that just by touching it, I guess my little finger must have hit the button, which just like opened up.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that happens often, but it's never happened to me before in a way that has been accidental.
Yeah.
And it was accidental and it happened. And I just think sometimes it's like, I fear that the audience smell blood.
Mm.
It's like your prey. And if you're an animal and you get up there and you're a little bit vulnerable, it's like, oh, amateur hour.
Yeah.
So having to like get them back into a place of like, no, yes, I did drop the mic cable out of the mic the moment I touched it. But I promise you, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm a professional comedian. You can trust me. Everyone relax. Is like that was a little bit, I think, a thing at the top of the set where I had to be like, oh fuck, okay, let me get them. Okay, be confident, let them know you know what the fuck you're doing.
Yeah. And because also comics are like a button, if there's like an on and off switch on a mic, you'll just see them and you're like, you've told them at the beginning, you're like, okay, there's an on and off switch, don't, because there was one at Angel and we'd be like, do not touch this button, and half the time comics would they're like, it's off, and it's like, you just touched the button.
But it's not, I guess it becomes that thing of like, it doesn't, if the worst thing is like it happening and you're not realizing it's happened.
Yeah,
that's when you're like, okay, right. And then the second thing is the comic not being able to get over that, or that being the moment, or something about it, you can tell they're nervous, or a wobble in the voice, or just like something. And I think it's those things happening is kind of like unavoidable.
Yeah.
But it's being able to like navigate them in a way that's really transparent and keeping your confidence, which I think is harder.
Yeah. Well, that's why I talk to people. I say this a lot on this podcast about gong shows, how they teach you how to keep an audience on your side. If you take away the competition side of it, if you go, right, I've got 5 minutes and I need to keep these 5 minutes, these people on my side for 5 minutes, it's such a good learning curve.
Yeah.
Because as you said, you could have lost them in that second of the mic. That it could have been a tough 20.
Yes. Though I think gong shows are tough.
Yeah, they are tough.
I guess, I know you guys, you beat the frog here, isn't it? Yeah, and it's quite a big one. But I don't know. I think gong shows ran differently in different venues.
Yes.
And I think that to say all gong shows is a gong show would be like to say all club nights are the same night. Actually, probably is ran very differently. I had a really bad time at a gong show in London. Well, a really bad time. I just remember I was the only woman. I think maybe, I'm imagining because women didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
But I think I was... there were 13 men in front of me.
Ooh.
And by the time I got up on stage, I remember hearing a woman in the audience gasp and be like, oh my God, there's a woman.
Mm.
And I think that is always a difficult energy with which to come on stage.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah, ours has been, I'm not being biased, but ours has been said it's a lot of like nicer. Good. One of the nicer ones.
Yeah.
You get exactly. about a minute or so, Grace.
Yeah.
Most people are lovely.
Okay.
The audiences, but they still want blood, but they're like, we're nice about it, we're in the north, so we'll be nice about it. Unlike London, where it's like, you've been on for 3 seconds, we don't like your shoes, off we go.
Yeah, exactly. Though I really haven't done very many.
Oh, okay.
I really didn't go down the gong show route. Yeah, but it's too adversarial. It's too adversarial, and I just think, why are you putting yourself through that? Me personally, it just was like, oh, I don't enjoy that energy.
Yeah. I think when you work normal roars of comedy, of when acts get to do full 5 minutes, you sometimes are like, oh, I wish we could just gong them off. As somebody who's watched lots of raw comedy, there are times, because I didn't understand the gong shows. We don't have that back home in Aotearoa. So when I was here, I was like, oh, it sounds really brutal. But then there were, once I saw the whole thing, I was like, no, sometimes it's actually, you know, you need to be carded.
You need to be that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because 5 minutes is a long time when it's not going well. I'm talking about if it's not going well. I'm talking about the extreme. I'm not talking about everybody.
Yeah, for sure.
When you see those people and you're like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, we've all been through them.
Yeah.
The open mic nights. 13 people on a bill doing 5 minutes. Yeah, that's the toughest part of doing stand-up, I think, is that initial bit.
Yeah, the beginning.
The bringer nights. And
that's only a London thing, you know. That's nowhere else.
I guess I can believe that. But Manchester, you must have quite a few nights for people to start off on.
Yeah, we've got heaps. No, I meant like we don't have the bringer
element to it, but where are the audience?
They just come.
Great.
Yeah, Manchester's very up for going out.
That's really
just
good.
Going and supporting stuff. So there's heaps of them all across Manchester City, and they all get crowds.
Great.
Yeah, because people just want to go out and
great.
And watch, you know?
Well, that's a dream, isn't it? And everywhere is like better than somewhere else, and everywhere's worse than somewhere else.
Yeah, that's true.
I went to New York. That was awful.
Really?
Awful. I remember thinking, oh my God, what a difficult place to try and start out in stand-up.
Oh, yeah.
I think you probably end up finding your... I didn't know anyone there, and so I wasn't in... I think there's more of like a Brooklyn kind of set that's a bit more artsy, and you can probably get easier stage, better quality stage time more quickly in that, or make the right inroads. But I was kind of going to like... the like Gotham Comedy Club and the Pear Tree, and like I can't remember they're called, but those ones doing their open mics, which begin at like midday.
Wow.
And you have to pay like $5 to play, and it's just comedians, like just just comedians and they leave the moment they've been on. And so there's just a roster of like maybe five people waiting to go on. They read their notes. They don't even attempt to laugh. And I just couldn't understand it. I was like, but what is the point of this? Some, and I know some comedians will say, well, if you can get them to laugh, you can get anyone to laugh. And I think that's not, I don't think that's true.
No.
I don't think that if, I'm not sure they'll ever laugh or.
Yeah.
It just, I certainly know that there's really good jokes that I see that I don't laugh at either because I'm just analysing my own set, which is going to be on afterwards, or because I'm thinking about how they wrote it, or it's just the brain is not switched on in the same way. It was really weird. I remember laughing at a guy's set and it threw him.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
So what took you to New York then? Was that like, when did you get into comedy and what made you drive you to go, I'm going to try in New York?
Well, I was only there for 3 weeks.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't like, it was just like I went to UCB, which is Upright Citizens Brigade, which is in New York, well, Chicago originally, but New York-based improv school.
Oh, cool.
And I did that because I was doing a lot of improv at the time. So I came from an improv background. And I wanted to do this course, and then I was going on to Chicago to do another course in Chicago with Second City, sketch writing. And I thought to myself, I had made a conscious decision maybe like 6 months prior that I was going to focus on stand-up.
Yeah.
Because I'd come from... I'd done an MA at drama school. I'd come from a desire to want to be an actor. And then I wasn't getting work. And I kind of found myself seeking out projects that could allow me to be self-driven and self-motivated. So I started writing and directing and putting on plays. And everything was always comedic because I was always a comedic actor. And it was comedic plays. And I mean, I can do all of the acting. But always my like talent was more in the comedy side of things. And then I think I had a friend who did one open mic night and I went along to that. But the thing you realize about stand-up is that it requires a dedication.
Yeah.
Which is like, you can't do it one night occasionally.
Yeah.
It's like, you have to certainly in the beginning to break the back of it, you have to be like, I'm doing only this.
Yeah.
And you have to gig a lot. And in order to do that, I had to decide that I wasn't going to do the other stuff. So I had a year where I was doing Edinburgh and I was going to do a play and I was doing a split bill. And I remember deciding, okay, after this, the acting is finished. Like I always want and still do want to go back into it and do more of it. But I didn't feel like there was any space for me in it or that it was going to get, my career was going to get anywhere. And I just remember being like, right, you know what? Stand-up's a place where you can really... do stuff. You can get on stage. You can.
Yeah.
There's real opportunity for you if you're just like motivated. There's opportunity to be creative in a way that's not ring fenced by anyone.
Yeah, and also you don't need much. You just need a mic and a sound system.
Exactly.
Like a you just even just need a speaker and maybe a good light that shunt is on you.
Yeah.
And that's all you really need.
Whereas that's all you need.
Theatre, you need a whole like stage manager. You need other actors. You need a director.
Precisely.
You need a tech. Like there's so much that goes into actually putting on your own play. It's quite daunting compared to going, you know what, I've got some friends. Let's just put on our own stand-up night. Let's find a pub. Let's got a room upstairs.
Yeah.
Boom.
Because even when I was writing and directing my own plays, it was like... I had to then find the actors and I had to do the production. And I just felt like with stand-up, you could be doing all of that just for yourself and also writing and also performing it. So it enabled you in many ways to sort of, on a very low and easy budget with very little admin, even though booking of gigs seems like admin, it is a lot of admin, but relative to running a play, for a minimum amount of admin, I was able to be really maximal creative.
Yeah.
So... that was when I decided I was going to focus. It was after the summer of 2018. I was like, all right, I'm going to focus on comedy. I was gigging a lot in London. And then went to New York because I'd heard that you could do all of these open mics all day.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, that is the home of stand-up. That is where people, like, that is, you think of modern stand-up, you think New York. I thought, right, I'm going to go to New York and that is where I'm going to break the back of being a stand-up comedian. That's where I'm gonna just soar ahead of the game and come back to London, this like transformed stand-up comedian. I'll be so much better than when I left. And I wasn't. But when I came back also, it was the pandemic. When was the pandemic? 2020?
2020, yeah.
Okay, so no, so it must have been later than that. So it would have been 2019, maybe it was 2018, I can't remember. But January, February 2020 was when I went to Chicago and New York.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And so by that point, I must have been doing stand-up. I think it was dedicatedly since 2018, summer 2018.
Yeah.
I came back September, I was like, no acting. So I'd been doing it for a year and a half when I went to New York.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when you kind of got there and were like, oh no, this is not what I thought it was. Did it kind of like, did you feel that? Like, was you like, oh,
yeah,
this is not what I thought actually?
No, yes, it was that. And also I was quite disappointed by the standard, I'd say.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that it wasn't as, I thought it was going to be more creative.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel very creative in like a kind of like fun eccentric kind of way, but Chicago actually really did. It felt more to me like people were just so desperate to try and get on the professional shows.
Yeah.
And I think it's difficult when that's like, and life was so hard. I feel like London's really got like that as well now, but it's so difficult to be a creative and live in New York.
Yeah.
Because the cost of living was so high. You'd have to, I think that the aspirations that people had to become professional comedian were also driven by the fact that, like, it's not fun being creative because I'm so thinking about what is my rent? How am I making ends meet? Like, the life is so squeezed that I think that you don't have the joy and the lightness that you probably do need in order to kind of, like, find those bits of experimental creativity. Whereas Chicago, I felt, was much more like that.
Yeah, and like, I don't know about New York, but I know about LA. I don't know if it's changed since I've read I'm Dying Up Here. I don't know if you know this book.
Who the fuck wrote that?
Actually, a guy, but it's all about the Comedy Store in LA.
Is it?
And it's about the strikes because she wouldn't pay them.
Well, who wouldn't pay them?
What was her name? Her name was Goldie in the TV series that they made about it. But it's Pauly Shore's mum. And I don't know if you know of Pauly Shore. You know, like, he was, like, in the Caveman movie. Like, he was, like, big in the 90s. He was in those kind of 90s films.
No, like, and do you know what? I'm the worst person to talk about original stand-ups because I'm not a stand-up buff or a nerd.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I actually really don't like to watch film stand-up.
Really?
It just doesn't interest me.
Mm.
I'm actually really good at watching my peers.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I'm up at Edinburgh, I can't remember how many shows I saw this year, but, you know, I'm watching everything. I'm seeing everyone.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
I go to the Soho Theatre all the time. I'm seeing everything. I'm watching everyone.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sit at home and put a stand-up special on.
No, but that's good.
I just don't do that. Which does mean, though, that I haven't sort of, like, watched all the classics. I wouldn't, you know, well, I wouldn't put myself in as a mastermind reference point for stuff.
No, he was just big as an actor in the 90s. Well, actor is a strong word. But his mum ran the Comedy Store. She made it famous, and she was the one who could get you onto Jimmy Carlson?
Yes, yeah.
So she could get you onto that, but she wouldn't pay you. So she was making all this money.
Right.
And so they've been protested. And I don't think, and then she started to pay them, but I don't think they've raised the fees since then. But yeah, so it was just the whole book of the history. So it was like David Letterman, Jay Leno, like it was all their history, like Eddie Murphy, it was all about them and their time in the comedy world during those LA times and how she kind of held all the power. Yeah, it's really fascinating.
It is. And I think that it's still an interesting conversation. And also, like, just I think the industry is going through another big change.
Yeah, social media is changing the game quite. We were talking about it before. Like, social media is really changing the game.
Big time. And I think that we haven't fully, the adaptation hasn't fully happened yet to what that's going to look like moving forward. I think people are still trying to understand how it's impacting the live comedy circuit.
Yeah.
But I think that it is definitely, it's a bit like, and now this is the post-pandemic social media push.
Yeah.
And we're going to see a changed industry. There's no doubt about that.
And you're doing really well on social media. So when did that kind of start for you? Like,
because that was the pandemic.
Really? Is that when you started doing your little
sketches?
Your sketches and
yeah. Because I only do sketches.
Yeah.
And there will be a point when this show that I'm doing at the moment, I'm taking on tour next year, when I record that as a special.
That's right, you're sold out here at the Frog.
I am actually,
you're sold out in Manchester.
Back.
Yeah.
When I do that as a special, then I'll clip that up, I'll post that online. But for the moment, I only do original content. And I think that that's another thing which is going to become a distinguishing factor in the way in which we sort of categorize people that do social media. Mm. Because they have different, because that creates also a different type of social media person.
Yeah. In what way do you think, like...
Well, for example, I don't think you can monetize social media if you're clipping up videos of yourself doing stand-up.
Okay.
Which I can, because I make original content. So an advertiser can see how you could use the content that I make in order to promote a product.
Oh, I see.
That was never a focus for me. I mean, I had no idea that could even happen or what that looked like. But if we're talking about the ways in which it's impacting stand-up, and I think revenue stream is definitely one, which makes a difference, because I think less and less we're going to have less and less people are going to live off being live stand-up comedians.
Mm.
Because it's really hard to make a living out of it.
Yeah.
And I think that even now, if you're a live stand-up, really, it's like your income is a bit of voice, a bit of writing work, a bit of the live gigging, maybe your own tour, a bit of this, bit of that. Yeah, it's like this kind of hybrid. And I think social media is another income stream that's coming into that.
Yeah.
And also, obviously, when you have a social media build, it also means that you can sell tickets to your own shows.
Yes, exactly.
But the engagement and the way in which an audience engages with you when you have original content versus stand-up is very different.
Yeah. And so how did that, like, during the pandemic, when did you think, I'm just going to start making these sketches and put them on? Because you know what I mean? Like, some people have done really, really well on social media from that pandemic. And then other people are like trying to catch up now and going, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. So when did that, because I think it's quite interesting to talk about really your journey. So when did you go, did it hit you straight away that this could be a space for you? Or did it take a little bit
to grow? It was December 2020.
Oh, really?
And I was working in a full-time job, which I'd not done in a structured way for a while, because before then I had been a tour guide, which was self-employed. And then obviously that industry shut down during the pandemic. And I'd managed to get a job as an admin assistant for a law firm, which I was doing from home. And it was interesting enough work, and I was good at it because I have a law degree, legal background. And,
oh, really?
And I think that it gave me, in a funny way, it gave me space to be creative.
Yeah.
Because my boss was really positive about me and was kind of like keen for me to stay on and become a solicitor. And I just remember thinking to myself, okay, well, do you know what? This gives you a space in which you're working from home. It's demanding, but not outside of the work hours you're already doing. It was really poorly paid, but it's the most money you've ever made. You know how much is coming in every month. You can clock off at 5 p.m. Like, there was a real structure to it, which outside of which I felt like I could really go like, oh, okay, cool. Well, you know what? When things open up again, you can just go back to gigging like you did before. And you can explore being creative. And even if it takes you 10 years, 15 years to build yourself up in the world of stand-up, you can keep doing this alongside of it.
Yeah.
So I'd started really thinking in a very long-term kind of way, which coming out of drama school, I was like, I want to be at the National next year. Whereas then, you know, I was much older. I mean, I was like 6 years in and I was like 31, I think, and I was starting to be more like, okay, yeah, no, this is definitely a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
And I genuinely had just gone through a breakup. I'd been seeing this guy that I really liked, and then things didn't work out between us. And so there was just so much time, you know, it was like another lockdown, and there was just so much time on our hands. And I can't remember whose videos I'd been watching on social media, but I just remember thinking, I feel like I could probably do that. And I think with this time on my hands, I just thought, fuck it, just challenge yourself to make. And I was always good at doing stories.
Okay.
So Instagram story has always been my thing. I was doing that before I started doing reels. I was doing that when I didn't have a following, when it was just me doing that. And I remember people messaging me and saying, your stories make me laugh so much.
Okay.
So I always knew that I was really comfortable doing Instagram stories, and I knew how to build narrative. And that is still something which I think is distinguishable about me and my social media, is that like my Instagram stories are really something which I really love doing, and are quite, yeah. Not everyone puts that much into them, but
yeah.
For me, they're a big part of the content that I create. And I just remember thinking, fuck it, just do like a video a day. And I did, or a video every other day, but I was making like, yeah, I was just making about kind of all different subject matters. Like I didn't have anything that I nested out to, but I was just like having a go.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was really honestly just throwing shit at the wall and seeing what stuck. And that was just it. And I think, but I was just doing it before a lot of other comedians were.
Yeah.
So I think that I was doing it, and no one else at that point properly was doing it yet.
Yeah.
So I guess I was early doors in the energy of like not being afraid to, yeah, I didn't really give a fuck.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, at this point, like I'll take anything, something give. Like I just don't care.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I think that's really inspiring, because a lot, especially as women, we tend to be like, oh no, you know, oh no, I can't do that. And it's like, that's really brave and like just courageous. I know it sounds silly that I'm saying that, but it actually is, to just be like, you know what, I'm just going to do it.
I think, but it's you've got to kind of be shameless. I remember hearing that a while ago, my sister saying to me, well, I just couldn't do that because I just, you know, the shame. And I think, however you frame it, it's like shamelessness, self-consciousness, being bold, being brave, being courageous. But ultimately what it comes down to is, I guess it's for you to ask yourself, if I put this out there and then people are literally like, oh my God, that's so cringe, or oh my God, that's so embarrassing, or like, that's not funny at all, or I can't believe she's making this content, or it gets 5 likes, really, like, what is the problem with that? Is it because you're worried your peers are going to see it and they're going to think that you're not funny? Is it because you're worried that other people don't like it? Is it because you're worried about strangers' reactions? Like, I guess it's really worth thinking about, what am I afraid of if I were to do that?
Yeah.
But I also knew that, like, I just wasn't getting anywhere quick enough.
Okay.
You know, it was like, I'm sure that eventually if I had persevered doing live stand-up and going through the route of like doing a mixed bill, another mixed bill, like doing a split at Edinburgh, doing competitions, like I feel confident that eventually it would have taken off, because I do think that that's something which I was really determined about and was putting the work in. And I know now, it's not like as if I go on bills and I'm like, I'm so out of my depth of stand-up. Like I did, I had stand-up capacities, but I think that what it enabled me to do really quickly with the online stuff was like build an audience.
Yeah.
And I think that, I was just like, fuck it, have a go.
Yeah.
And I do think you do have to have a bit of that.
Yeah.
Is it like a letting go of ego? I don't know. It's just kind of like, what's the worst that's going to happen? Like, whatever.
Yeah. Because, I mean, at the grand scheme of things, if it doesn't get any likes, then no one's actually really going to see it.
In but a also way, it doesn't know? Matter.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so easy. Don't think about that, because that's the kind of shit which is like, that's the kind of stuff that keeps people down. Mm. Being worried about who's seeing the fact that he hasn't got any likes.
Yeah.
Doing the work is putting the work out there.
Yeah.
Once it's out there, analyze it in as much as you can ask yourself, why didn't that work? What can I do better? Mm. What can I do better next time?
Mm-mm.
But ultimately, the most important thing is that you're doing the work.
Yeah.
Like the fact that you're making content, you're putting out there is 90% more than 99% of other people.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
how you're going to distinguish yourself, because ultimately yeah. it's just you're making work and you're putting it out there. And it might be the 15th video that you do that takes off.
Yeah.
But you've just got to keep trying and making the content and doing more content and just being reactive and listening and looking, okay, why is that not working? What do they like about this? How do I feel comfortable? What works for me? But you have to start somewhere in order to get to that place.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, all of that is conversations around vulnerability and not being afraid to fail. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, none of those things were things that I did consciously. I wasn't having that conversation with myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that I probably was just a little bit more prematurely shameless than others. And I just went, fuck it.
Well, also, too, at that time, there was nothing to lose because we're all locked up.
I had nothing to lose and I had no reputation.
Yeah.
I wasn't like an established stand-up who was trying a hand at doing socials. It's like, I had no... I was just starting to get some paid gigs.
Yeah.
I didn't have a profile to ruin.
Yeah.
I was,
yeah.
You know, I was absolutely nobody. I wasn't getting professional work. It was like, I could only use, it was only up from there.
Yeah. 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 And then how much do you spend making, like, do ideas come to you straight away, or does sometimes you have to, similar to like writing a play or your sketches? Yeah, like how much time are you putting in behind the scenes? Because some people are working all the time with their social media. Like it's a full-time job.
I would say that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Full-time, yeah.
Yeah, constantly.
Constantly, yeah. I mean, yeah, I do content every day.
Yeah.
If not every other day. And the thought of it and the kind of like, right, when's my next video? I need to do that. I need to do this. And also because I do collaborations, I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about that work element. I'm thinking about that, my contract, and to negotiate that. And when's that in the diary for? Yeah, it's all the time. It's always there. It's omnipresent.
Wow. Mm. And then you're also, I read that you're writing a book. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, nonfiction.
Nonfiction, yeah.
So is it going to be a biography or is it just going to be?
Yeah. It is. It's going to be a sort of... I mean, I don't know how much I'm supposed to be talking about.
Oh, sorry.
Well, only because I haven't sold it yet. So it's at the proposal stage.
I just read that somewhere and I was like, oh, that's fascinating.
It is. And I really, really enjoy it. I really, really enjoy it. And I'm really passionate about it. And I'm looking forward to having the space in which I can really dedicate to that. I was working on it today.
Oh, cool.
But that's, you know... That's another thing to balance.
Yeah.
You know, the live show, the social media.
Yeah.
The new creative projects like a book, like, you know, any scripts you might be working on developing, writing projects, writing a new show.
Yeah.
It's all part of, I think, this conversation that I think comedians are having more and more about how much the job has changed.
Yeah.
You know, in the last sort of 15 years or whatever, it's no longer all you have to do is be funny.
Yeah.
Write jokes.
Do the circuit.
Do the circuit. Build up to a one-hour show. Hopefully the show goes well. Take it on tour. Because of that, end up on TV. Sell more tickets for the tour. Goes back round in a circle. Now it's just so many different aspects of your work that end up being, you know, super hyper important. And you are very much an entrepreneur.
Yeah, 100%. It has become... a business in sense. But one thing I think I love and admire about stand-ups is it is your own business to a degree. You know what I mean? Like we were saying at the beginning, like as an actor, there's so many people you have to jump through hoops and it's got nothing to do with talent.
But I think with actors, it's becoming the same thing. Mm. I think creatives in general, actually, I would say it's becoming all part of the same thing in as much as if you're an actor... There is so much more hunger now and appetite for the Michaela Coles, the Phoebe Waller-Bridges. So we want you to be an actor who's probably also written something.
Yeah.
And that one-hour show was the thing that was like your calling card. And you're acting, but you're directing, and maybe you're also writing a book.
Yeah.
You have to be these kind of like multi-talented individuals or you're not, and in which case you were someone who probably rose up really quickly, but that's like the super minority of people. But I think that now if I was speaking to people who were in my position 7 years ago, or even more than that, when did I come out of drama school? We're going to 2023, like 7-8 years ago. When I was at drama school, I'd be saying, write stuff, put a play on, do a short film, because maybe 0.1% of you are going to end up getting signed by someone big, and then you're going to go on to pick up work, and but the rest of you are not, and you're going to feel really creatively stunted.
Yeah.
And this is how you can build your careers, and also you're not going to be able to make a living out of it for a really long time. Like, even now, if you're in the West End, barely enough money to pay your rent in London.
Yeah.
So it's just changed so much. And I think that, again, even for actors, being online, building a profile, it's just like another part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which can be quite overwhelming for a lot of people. And somewhat, do you think sometimes?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. And I think it's really, I think it's shit.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's bad that I don't think it's quite got to the point yet where if you don't have a social media following you can't succeed.
Yeah.
And I think that there's still a sense of like the industry do want to discover you. But I think that the more people realize how much money can be made from people because of their following and the immediacy of the audience that you've created,
yeah,
and how much more work it takes to build someone up, I think the more that there's going to be, I think it will become really normal for comedians. I think a big aspect of work, which hasn't been developed yet, but that will, I would imagine, come, is comedians ghostwriting for social media personalities.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think if I was, that was more my side of the industry, which it isn't. I don't really tend to write that much for people. But if I were doing that kind of work, I'd probably be thinking about ways in which I could connect to social media agencies and offering up my services to help develop and also to help make social media content funnier, even at this point, because social media has changed so much. In the beginning, anyone who made their fame on Instagram through being a visual personality, someone who is attractive, which there was a lot of, the initial Instagram was like aspirational lifestyle Instagram.
Yeah.
That's all changed now and we're into the authentic.
Yeah.
And so now we want people who are funny, who are authentic. I don't know what the next wave's going to be, but there'll be a next wave.
Yeah.
So, you know, even as a social media person, you have to kind of be like mindful. You have to be mindful of that as well. But yeah, I think that there is still, obviously, like, you always need to have space for people. Like, Dan's done brilliantly. Dan is on the line up here, Dan Tinnan, nominated in Edinburgh. Dan, I don't think he even has an Instagram.
No.
Or maybe he does. No, he does. But like, he's not at all, barely uses it, not at all on social media. It doesn't, you know.
He won all the awards, but yeah.
Won all the awards, being pushed everywhere, like, Lorna Trine Rose, another one who's just done fantastically. Two super talented comedians. They don't have like big social footprints. And so you don't have to have it to be successful. And I think that's super important we keep that, because it's a whole other skill set.
Yeah.
It's a whole other skill set. And you cannot be asking people to be brilliant stand-up comedians and original and funny, but then also like edit your own videos.
Yeah.
Build your own. But I try to encourage people to think of social media as a way, as like a creative tool.
Yeah.
Like, try and think of not how do I put my onstage persona into social media, but how can I look at this and be like, oh, this is a new chat. Like, how can I be funny on here?
Yeah. Yeah, someone was saying before in the green room, actually, about another comedian. I won't mention their name, but they're a big comedian. And about how they were trying to clip their set. And they said, no, use all the stuff, your jokes that don't work. Use that as a rant and just have yourself on your phone. So these are the jokes that probably you've tried once or twice. They're just not got any legs. You know they don't have legs. So use that as a rant, because you can know it's kind of funny, but you're not wasting your material. because it's your B grade stuff.
Yeah.
And you just use it as a rant that you've just come up with, but actually it's
something.
To be great and be yourself and authentic, and that's people will probably follow that more than you go, okay, which 40 seconds of my set can I give up?
Yeah. Though obviously some people build up these great audiences through audience interaction clips.
Yeah.
But that's also kind of changing, I think, the relationship with audiences.
Yeah.
I feel like the other day I did a gig at Top Secret and they were very Gen Z, like everyone was in their 20s, and I really felt like they were not interested. I was watching the acts before me and I was like, they're just not interested in hearing jokes. They just want to be spoken to. They just want the interaction. And I wonder how much, because loads of new audiences are coming to stand up through social media.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much their concept of what social media is, I wonder if what their idea of what stand up is in live, live stand up is different to what live stand up actually is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's another thing we're going to have to contend with.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Well, I mean, the next show's about to begin.
So we should probably go downstairs and watch.
We should go downstairs so you can watch the show. But thank you so much for coming to do this.
Thank you for having me.
It's been really interesting.
I'm just going to have to say this because I feel like I need to tell Amy off. Amy was like, I came to do this recording. I'm here anyway. And I said to Amy, oh, do you mind if we do it at 7? I'm going to pop out and do some shopping. Amy said, yeah, no problem. I come back. I realize that Amy has been waiting for me. The only person that is precluding Amy to go home on this cold, cold, dark, wintry build up to Christmas Saturday night, stopping her from getting home, putting a log on the fire, watching a little bit of telly.
Strictly.
Is me. Is me. And I'm going to tell you off, Amy, because you should have said to me, oh, do you mind if we do the recording first? Just because then I'm going to... even if you said I need to get home, I would have been like, of course, babes.
No, of course. I'm too much of a Kiwi. That's not what we're like as a country.
Anyone who comes and does this podcast, please know that that's the kind of thing that Amy will do.
Yeah,
so be mindful of that. Just, you know, diarize it as soon as possible because bless her, she will wait for you and then you'll feel terrible.
No, don't feel terrible. You're coming to do the podcast. It makes me happy to wait. I think that's a nice way to end it. There we go.
Thank you for having me.
No worries.